Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Very exciting episode today. First time ever, we are not going to be talking about reality TV. We're going to be talking about our first scripted series, and that is, of course, one of our favorites, Breaking Bad. I'm Colin. Dom, what's going on?
Well, arguably our first scripted series, at least, depending on your views of Big Brother. But yeah, very excited to be talking about this today. I know we promised this to you a few weeks ago and have failed to deliver yet, but finally it's here, and we hope it's worth the wait. I mean, I think if you've watched the season at all so far, you're going to be excited to hear about it. Maybe not from us, but there's a lot of good material to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Breaking Bad is one of those shows where, really, as far as I can tell, every scene kind of matters, or at least could matter, for the kind of format that we're dealing with, where we're really looking at the story in depth the way we would kind of with Survivor or Big Brother. But this, of course, is about something scripted. Breaking Bad is one of those shows where I think every scene, there's nothing we can really rule out at this point. I think Vince Gilligan does a great job of making everything kind of have some kind of at least minor importance.
Yeah, this is the first show we covered where the writers get to craft everything that they want in the show, and so it's not like they're given something to work with and then they have to do what they can with it. They get to choose everything, and so for people who like to analyze things in detail, that's a great thing. It means that we can talk about every minute of every show.
Yeah, definitely. And if you guys end up liking this, or even if you don't, after part one of this season concludes, which is going to be after episode 8, so 3 weeks down the line, we're going to be joined by someone we've talked to about his own game playing Survivor, but we're going to be talking to him about Breaking Bad. That is, of course, the great Stephen Fishback coming back on the show after part one concludes, to kind of wrap that up and also look ahead to the final 8 episodes of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, if you've watched him on Survivor or if you've listened to him on our show, you know he has a great analytical mind. So, yeah, I'm very excited to have him on as a guest, especially for this.
I guess it kind of goes without saying, you know, if you haven't watched all of Breaking Bad, we're going to be talking exclusively about Season 5 for the most part today. And if you don't want to know about anything that happens in Season 5, of course, this is going to be a big-time spoiler alert. Here is your alert. I would recommend not listening to this if you don't want to be spoiled. And I would recommend if you then need something to do with your time, what better could you be doing with your time than catching up on Breaking Bad?
Yeah, if you haven't watched Breaking Bad and you're listening to this, what the fuck are you doing? Stop what you're doing right now and go back and watch it. Like,
yeah. I can assure you, you're going to have a much better time watching it than listening to us.
Yeah, that goes without saying.
I think before we actually get into discussing Season 5, Breaking Bad is a show, at least for me, and I'm going to ask you on your own list, this is an elite show all time, and I've seen a lot of every episode of many, many, many drama series, and this is easily in my top 5 for sure. I'll give you my exact ranking in just a minute, but Dom, where does this fall for you?
Okay.
Season 1 through what we've seen so
far. Well, as someone who's obviously not from the US and who has therefore only watched a limited amount of American TV, given that America's where most of the quote-unquote top shows come from, I don't really have a very informed perspective on this. Like, for me, if you ask me what the top shows were, it'd be stuff like Extras or the UK version of The Office, otherwise known as The Office.
Downton Abbey?
Maybe, yeah, that's out there as well. But beyond that, like, I'm at least theoretically aware of a lot of shows that are in the discussion for a lot of people. So stuff like Mad Men, The Sopranos, The Shield. I guess Lost, if you're interested in what they were trying to do and like the way in which they did it. And various other shows as well. But I think even after the first season of Breaking Bad, people were starting to put it into the discussion. And I think it's stood the test of time. People were wondering maybe the show jumped a shark a few seasons down the line, but we're 4.5 seasons in now and it's as good as it ever has been.
Yeah, and this is something you really don't see that often, as a show maintaining its strength. I think, just to get right into it, I have Breaking Bad as my number 2 show of all time, and it has outs to get to number 1. And yes, Dom, I can see you smiling. I am a blatant and open fantard for The Wire, and you would be too if you watched The Wire.
I love how it took less than 5 minutes for you to derail a Breaking Bad podcast with your love for The Wire.
It's not going to be the last time, and I'm going to try to contain myself. But when we're talking about characters, listen, you should be, you know more than anyone how much I love The Wire. And for Breaking Bad to draw so many comparisons to it, I think is a super high form of praise, as high form of praise can be coming from me.
Well, just to enable you for a minute, I still don't understand why you have The Wire out there. It's just guilt porn for rich white people.
Not at all, my God, not at all, not at all. It's the same thing as Survivor, it's the same idea as Game of Thrones, it's roughly the same as Breaking Bad, where it's a political game played with human pieces. It's the same idea.
I guess you could argue the same thing about Breaking Bad as well. Like, it allows people to sit comfortably in their homes in suburbia and have this escapist fantasy of what it would be like to be a renegade leader of a drug empire. But The Wire takes it to a whole new level. Like, this is just people thinking they're suddenly experts on the plight of the inner cities, you know, having watched their Wire box set religiously. It's not...
Right, but it's not about the plight of the inner city so much. It's set in the setting of a impoverished inner city Baltimore. But it's not. It's more about people like jockeying for position, as far as I see it. And, you know, like, people watch Survivor for many different reasons. We watch it because it's a game, and The Wire, to me, I think is one of, like, the, as, even if you just look at it, and this is not the only way to look at it, but as, like, a game, it's just brilliant stuff, because the ramifications, instead of the winner getting $1 million and the losers getting a certain amount of money and then voting for a winner, is you declare your political allegiances, and these are swinging all the times, but instead of voting people out or ending business with them like you might in Mad Men or whatever, you are killing people.
Yeah, one of the sort of central things you have to think about with shows like this is, like, how far they conform to a certain type of realism, like whether they kind of take liberties with, like, the truth of the environment that they're portraying in order to create a good narrative for the show. I think with The Wire, at least this is my impression, they try to be as realistic as possible, and in the process ended up, like, stifling what could have been maybe a more interesting show on a kind of, like, a base level, where it doesn't really capture your attention unless you're predisposed to like the show to begin with. Whereas I think with Breaking Bad, even if you're just sitting back watching it for a cheap thrill, it's still something which captures your attention and holds you in.
Now, see, this strikes me as the opinion of someone who has watched the beginning of The Wire, not found it that thrilling, and then never continued, which, if I can make a confession, was me. I watched the pilot episode 4 times before moving on to episode 2, with about 9 months in between each attempt, because all I ever heard about was how great The Wire was, and I kept not being able to get into it. And when I finally just forced myself and said, okay, you're going to sit and watch this show, I've never seen anything better. And I think part of the reason for that slowness, I agree with you that David Simon, the guy who created and did much of the writing and story developing for it, and I promise you guys, we will talk about Breaking Bad shortly. but this is just, I think, two of the most widely regarded as the greatest shows ever made. I think this is a very worthwhile discussion, and this is a discussion that is certainly going to be had when Breaking Bad is all said and done, because it will be in the conversation for the greatest shows ever done. I think The Wire, that kind of slowness is David Simon's attempt to develop characters organically as if it's literally like just watching a documentary. And I think that's a valid criticism for sure, but it's also worth understanding that over the course of the show, there are like 75 characters you need to get to know, and there's just not that much screen time to develop them all in big, flashy ways with episodes that kind of tie everything together. It's a season ties everything together, or the whole series will tie together storylines, and it's really just getting one piece at a time, and then, much like Breaking Bad, kind of piecing it together, looking back on what you've already seen and discovering the significance of it from there.
Yeah, I can see that. Maybe this isn't a specific criticism of The Wire then, but just of any kind of ambitious project like that, where they're trying to effectively create this world, even though what they're doing is trying to represent real life. They're trying to create this world which, you know, is complex and has all these things going on in it, but which they have to portray effectively in sort of set, isolated, 1-hour segments that have to like stand independently and in relation to each other. And that's not an easy thing to do. Like, I'm not saying that I could have done anything better necessarily, or that the writing team was just failed in that regard, but I don't think this is something which can ever really be done as effectively as I think a lot of Wire fans would like to think that it has been.
Maybe it's just a matter of personal preference, because for me, I think I have 4 dramas well above all the others, those being The Wire, Breaking Bad, The Sopranos, and Oz, in that order, 3 of the 4 being HBO shows, Breaking Bad being AMC, of course. And I think one of the common themes there is, for the most part, pretty much no cliffhangers. Every episode is somewhat self-contained, but plays a key piece in the larger picture. But at the same time, you can kind of appreciate it concludes itself. It's not like, for instance, Lost, you reference, where the goal of every episode is basically to get you to tune in the next week, because we see what happens when that's the goal. You write yourself into a corner, and then you can never find a satisfying ending. In such an effort to just keep coming up with these big cliffhangers to keep people tuning in, They delved so far into the realm of unrealisticness after, you know, in the middle of season two, really, and early in season one, like the polar bear, spoiler alert, or whatever, people who haven't watched Lost. But I think there's something about these shows, that, like the ones that I just listed, where, for whatever reason, even though, and maybe it's counterintuitive, because people do, cliffhangers are popular for a reason, people like that kind of suspense, and people do tune in to find out what happens, but I think, at the end of the day, when you want to appreciate a show historically, you prefer the ones that gave you resolution at the end of week to week. Like, it wasn't such a desperate attempt just for ratings, I think. This is more people, I think it comes across more as people trying to tell a story.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not saying that people who like The Wire and who do place it above Breaking Bad are wrong necessarily, and I think this is something that we do have to keep in mind. Typically, when we talk about shows, we're talking about stuff like Survivor and Big Brother, and specifically the strategy of those shows, where to some extent you can kind of logically deduce the quote-unquote correct answer to any particular question. But with something like this, I think a lot of it is largely subjective, and it comes down to personal preference. And there are some objective things that we want to say, but I think that's important to keep in the back of our minds when we move on to the Breaking Bad discussion.
Yeah, and one of the big themes that I think I'm going to be hitting on in terms of why I think this show and Vince Gilligan specifically is so brilliant is, like The Wire and like many other shows that I'm a fan of, one thing that they always seem to take into account is the idea that we kind of need reasons for it. Like, I'll reference this later when we talk about, off the top of my head, like Ted pushing this lie on Marie about Skyler's affair with Ted Beneke really being the reason this whole family's falling apart, because it addresses the issue of, it's been, you know, a year now, Hank and Marie would probably be onto something by now, and this Vince Gilligan then says, okay, well, they think it's this other issue, and I think many shows don't go so far as to address, like, the natural human concerns that the main characters would always be facing. I think, like, 24, for instance, is a show that gets probably too much praise for stuff like this, where, hey, I think 24 more was about the cliffhangers and the clock running out and what's gonna, is he gonna make it in time or whatever, and for me, that's just not, I think, with Breaking Bad, it's just not the case.
Yeah, I think 24 is good at doing what it sets out to do. But what it sets out to do, I think, the best of the genre that 24 resides in is automatically, I think, going to be of less kind of like artistic merit than the best of the genre that a show like Breaking Bad aspires to be in.
Right, and it's because 24's and Lost are network shows that have to, they're trying to get 25 million people to watch. They're not trying to get 2 million people.
Yeah, and at the risk of sounding elitist, if you're trying to market a show to a wider audience, that you're going to have to make certain sacrifices in terms of quality, I think. And you can argue maybe the best shows are able to do that without sacrificing anything, but it's very rare that a show is able to remain intact and expand beyond the audience that I think would naturally be drawn to it.
Yeah, you look at Arrested Development, you don't really need to look much further. It's probably the greatest comedy ever made, and people just couldn't really hang with it when it was on a network.
Yeah, or look at a show like Community, which I know we're both big fans of, where it's clearly a better show by almost any metric that you would want to bring in than a show like Two and a Half Men or whatever, and yet Two and a Half Men consistently crushes it in the ratings, and Community has, you know, has needed lifelines almost since its inception. So
Community's on Friday nights now at like 8:30. It's just such a brutal time slot, although I'm hoping it rallies the fan base, but I'm not even so confident that's going to matter now that Dan Harmon's out.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk at a later date maybe about the Pels.
Well, we came here to talk about Breaking Bad, so let's get into that right now.
Sure.
And today what we're going to be doing is talking about the first 5 episodes of Season 5. Hopefully everyone has seen these episodes and everything, and Dom, I gotta say, I'm loving the season so far.
Yeah, definitely. Just to talk about the format for this episode briefly, we weren't quite sure how to do it, because we typically like to go over whatever we're talking about in chronological order. I think that's still the best way to do it with Breaking Bad, although we do expect to be jumping between episodes and themes a lot of the time, so it's not just going to be going through like a list and sticking rigidly to that at all.
Right, definitely. And I think the first thing that we're going to see about like jumping around between episodes is the opening sequence of season 5 is Walt sitting at this, you know, diner with his hair grown back and he's got a beard now, and he writes out the number 52 with his bacon on top of his eggs, which we'll later see a few episodes down the line him writing out 51. So we now know, after seeing the 51 scene, that this is a year to the day after Walter does the 51 scene. And thus, I think we can interpret that Walt is going to be making it out of this, at least for another year, alive, and probably thus making it through the end of the series alive and out of jail, which I think is something obviously worth getting right into, because it's the first scene of the entire season. So this is going to come in, and they don't, yeah.
Well, when you say he's going to make it through the series, you mean you think that the last minute of the season six, or I guess season five finale, Walt is still alive and remains that way?
What I'm thinking is they've stuck pretty closely with keeping the time pretty consistent on the show. Like, I it's weird to me, but I think the show is still in like 2008 time. And I think if we're going through, it's going to end less than a year after the 51 episode, the one where he's spelling out 51 in his big. And so I'm assuming that this is going to mean, I think, basically, in summation, I think season five is going to be leading up basically to this moment.
Yeah, to say something about the pacing of the events that we might expect to see, if we think back to season one, like the first scene we see there is it's Walt's 50th birthday. And so, and we see Walt's 51st birthday during this season. So all the events of the first four and a half seasons have been crammed into essentially a year's worth of showtime. And so given that we're expecting to see another year of that, everything that happens in that year, which we expect to be even more eventful than the year he's just had, given that he's now a full-fledged leader of a drug empire and all the drama that comes with that, that's all going to be compressed into one season, or I guess 16 episodes worth of viewing, which is going to make for great TV, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And this is, right away we see, basically when I say I think it's all going to lead up to that moment, what I mean is I think the end of season five is going to lead up to what we see at the beginning of season five, which is Walt, who's now got a fake name as Mr. Lambert, goes in and buys an M60, which is a heavy assault rifle, from what I can tell. And I basically think the way the show is going to conclude is we're going to find out the reason Walt needs this M60, like who's coming after Walt. And then maybe the final episode will pick up from this point on or whatever.
Yeah, this is literally Chekhov's gun. Like, you don't plant this here unless this is significant in some way. And this is a common theme that we see with the cold opens at the beginning of each season, where there's some scene which requires some kind of deconstruction. It's not immediately clear what's happening or what the implication of the events shown is going to be, and then the whole season it kind of leads up to that. For instance, at the beginning of season two, we see the scene of the teddy bear in the pool with half its face scorched, and in one of the Breaking Bad Insider podcasts, which I suggest going back and listening to if you haven't already, actually, it's basically one of the editors on the show, Kelly Dixon, talks to Vince Gilligan and various actors from the show, various people who work on production, about how they make the show, the logistics of it, the editing, that sort of thing. And one of the things that Vince Gilligan said there is when they were writing season two, they were so enamored with the idea of having this shot at the beginning that basically everything that came after in the season was based on, well, how do we work up to this? So the ending of season two, i.e. the plane crash, which I think a lot of fans, when it aired, were kind of skeptical about. They didn't really like the ending as much as they could have done. That was put in place because they thought it was the most natural way to lead to this shot, which they had fallen in love with at the beginning. So when you see a scene like this, and we see again at the beginning of season three with the cousins and others in the crawl scene towards the picture of Walt in the shrine, whenever you see something like this, you have to know that this is the end game. This is what's going to happen at some point, and the only question is how we get there.
One of the things that I wanted to mention, actually, is that pink teddy bear motif that I read an article about on Warming Glow or something. If you just Google in Breaking Bad pink teddy bear motif, basically what we've seen is, the eye pops out of it and Walt then gets in touch with the eye. And then at the beginning of season four, the eye, Skyler is in Walt's apartment and the eye rolls out of the drawer that she's snooping around in. And then she starts turning evil. And basically people who come into contact with that eye that we've seen, from what I can basically from what I understand, is that's kind of like the symbol for, okay, this person's literally about to start breaking bad, as in they're about to start turning towards the dark side, basically. And so I'm actually on the lookout. I told myself before the start of the season, I want to see that eye again. And I was thinking, is Walt Jr. going to come across it, or what's going to happen here?
Yeah, well, another sign of how much the writers liked that image was at the end of season four, which when they were writing it, they thought could be the last season potentially. They needed an ending for that season that would close it out as a season and as a series, while also leaving it open-ended in case they were renewed for another season. One of the things we see there is Gus, when he gets his face blown off, it's basically a mirror image of the teddy bear in the pool with half of its face scored. Right? They chose to replicate that. At that point, it became an iconic image for the show.
Yeah, and also at the beginning of season four, one of the very first shots is of some kind of like face on a shelf with half of the, so like, not exactly like you'd see it like a doctor's office to pull out like the parts for anatomy or whatever, but something very similar with half the face missing. So then moving on from here, you know, that's the end of the cold open, and then after that, we get kind of the end of season four again, which I actually liked. I thought it was helpful to kind of reset everything up. What'd you think about that?
Yeah, I wasn't really a big fan of this. I obviously, for exposition's sake, it's kind of necessary. Like, for instance, if you have someone who has just come to the show, they see the premiere of season five, they want to know what's going on. And the best way to do that is to replicate exactly what you showed at the end of last season. But I think the way in which they set this up, it kind of dragged on a bit too long. I think once you're going to show what is essentially old footage, you have to kind of end that and move on as quickly as you can. And instead, they chose to prolong it with a scene of Walt Jr. Begging Walt to come and watch the TV because old Gus Fring's died and they don't know what's happened. This sort of thing. I don't know. It just felt like they were retreading old ground, but doing so in a way which was not boring, but it kind of dragged on a bit too long, I thought.
See, I thought after having just seen him as with his hair grown out and a beard as Mr. Lambert, this was a nice way to kind of reset the timeline and get us back into where we were going. And as far as the Walt Jr. scene, I thought perhaps that it dragged on deliberately because it's kind of showing everyone, Walt Jr. is really representing like the general public here, like, oh my God, this is a huge deal, this is a huge deal. And for Walt, it's like, the guy's dead, I've won, I'm out of danger now, this is great, I'm going to have a celebratory drink. I don't really care what the news is saying, Gus Fring is dead, I'm in good shape now. And this also could potentially kind of represent Walt's new attitude along those same lines, is like, I'm the guy in charge now, like, I'm above all this.
Yeah, well, I think what we're going to see over the course of the season, and we have already, is Walt is going to gradually assume the role and the power, and I imagine some aspects of the personality that Gus embodied. And I think it's a nice way to kind of firstly contrast Walt with Gus, like, to remind the audience of the struggle they had for the past few seasons, and then to, like, introduce a new phase in that struggle. However, I'm just not really a fan of the way they did it. I think it could have been done more quickly, left more time for other events in the episode, and I don't think that having Walt Jr. beg his father over and over again to watch the TV was a good way of incorporating that into the episode.
Well, if you're not going to do that many scenes about breakfast, I feel like you have to find some kind of way to get Walt Jr. on there. So now we get kind of a cool scene with Walt and Skyler where they're in their bedroom and Skyler's kind of relieved and scared, and she's scared of Walt and she's scared of everything, and Holly's right in between them and they're kind of going back and forth at each other. What do you think about this, though? Because this thing, you know, we see plenty of Walt and Skyler kind of going back and forth this season, and this is the first one.
Yeah, it definitely helps to set the tone for their relationship in future episodes, and I think it's obviously going to change markedly now that Walt's in this new position, and that basically since everything has now changed in Walt's life, part of that includes his relationship with Skyler. And so we need to introduce that early, given this is the premiere, it's going to be a recurring theme throughout the season.
I also think, given the way that we end up seeing Skylar's story play out, at least so far, where she's kind of going crazy, for lack of a better term, this is kind of a good way to set up why she might, like, provide the viewer with reasoning for why she's getting so, acting out so, like, emotionally, if she's really, like, scared, and like she's glad Walt's alive and everything, but now she's scared for herself and for her family and everything. And instantly, they're arguing with little baby Holly right in between them, which I think, given all the discussion that's been had about keeping the kids safe this season, was kind of supposed to be viewed as weird. But I've always been, and this is a bit of a lighter note, I've always been of the policy that you can really say whatever you want in front of a baby. They're just babies. They're not going to remember or anything. So it didn't have the effect on me, but I thought it was pretty cool.
It's often one of the minor things that gets pointed out about TV shows is that the babies in them are always surprisingly well behaved. Like, you never have these scenes where they're crying endlessly and nobody knows what to do and it ends up disrupting the plot or anything. The babies are always surprisingly quiet, and maybe they just didn't want the expense of having to find an actual real live baby. I don't know.
It's kind of like Chekhov's gun. If you see a baby that's not quiet, get ready for that to end up coming into play later.
I think you're maybe extending the Chekhov concept a bit too far, but yeah, I see where you're going with that.
Chekhov's baby. All right. Okay, and then this is actually, the next shot is very cool. It's of Hank and Gomi, his partner Gomez, in the lab wreckage, and it's a kind of an overhead shot that we saw several times in previous seasons of, of the old cooking lab in Gus Fring's laundromat, where it's the overhead shot, and I thought it'd be cool kind of, because we always saw, the kind of orange vibe, and they're wearing the yellow or orange jumpsuits, and they've got the big silver tins, and now it's all black and, like, melted metal and everything. I thought it was a very cool shot, and I'd be interested in seeing it, like, juxtaposed against Walt and Jesse cooking previously.
Yeah, the lighting I thought was fantastic, and the way in which they, like, conveyed the fact that the lab's just completely destroyed, I think it was done pretty perfectly as well. And I like this because it symbolised that, again, there's this contrast between, like, the old order where Gus is in control, Walt was kind of having to constantly fight for his life, and now Walt Gus had is completely destroyed, and we're in a new set of affairs now, and that set of affairs is Walt achieving supremacy.
Yeah, and not to focus too much on the visual aspect of it, but I'm pretty sure to start season four, or maybe there was a promotional shot of Walt and Jesse down on the floor of the lab looking up at the camera, and then I think the beginning of this shot was Hank and Gomez looking up, holding their flashlights up, checking out, like, the security camera, which by extension was then them looking right into the camera similarly. I may be making that up. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's not confirmed.
Yeah. The only thing I disliked about the scene was it introduced the storyline for the episode, which I thought was a pretty poor storyline, which is that Gus supposedly was keeping camera footage of everything that went on in the lab, and now Walt and Jesse need to find this because potentially if it's found by the police, it could be used to incriminate them. So they have to go on this wild goose chase to go and find the laptop containing the camera footage and find some way to either physically destroy the laptop or neutralize it in some way.
See, I disagree with that. I think this is a great way. I think this episode served very well to kind of end the Gus Fring era, put some closure on, like, okay, there are no loose ends left over there. The security footage is totally wiped, and now Vince Gilligan doesn't have to deal with people saying, oh, what about Gus's laptop? They could have totally found it, and the police surely would have, and whatever. I also think it helps to set up the Walt power trip that he seems to be going on. It also serves to set up Jesse, who's all of a sudden a big problem solver. I think it does plenty actually for the show, and I don't think it by any means it was a waste of time. Plus, I think it was fun. I think this is certainly an episode that can stand alone because it was very like a mission established, mission accomplished thing, and I thought that was good for a season premiere where now everyone's back in Breaking Bad mode and we can get more onto the longer storyline. Everyone's reminded of what's happening, and we got some excitement, we got some magnets, bitch, and we got a satisfying ending for this little episode. I thought it totally served its purpose.
Okay, to go through that in order. Firstly, I don't think this was necessary. Like, if the writers had instead chosen to say, well, look, all the cameras were destroyed in the fire, I think everyone watching would have been perfectly fine with that. It's not as if some plot hole would have been opened up by this scene not being there. Like, if the fact that they chose the storyline to include in the episode means that they felt it had some other purpose other than just tying up a loose end from season four. To go on to the second point, I think I disagree with you fundamentally about what the purpose of a premiere should be. Like, I think you're right in saying that this episode was a lot more self-contained than a lot of episodes are. In shows in general, but Breaking Bad in particular, there are a lot of longer-term story arcs over the course of one season or multiple seasons, and these can range from minor things to major things. For instance, if we think back to last season, one of the main things that they had to deal with was, well, Walt has all this money now, and they need some way to disguise that. So they need to find a way to do that, and then they need to execute that. So they settle on the car wash, and then for a few episodes, one of the main things is, well, they need to acquire the car wash and then make sure that they can launder all the money effectively and so on. And this is something which continues for multiple episodes. Here, it's like, so they identify a problem pretty early on, they find a way to fix it, and they fix it, and then that's the end, and then they move on to other things. I think that's fine, like, somewhere in the middle of a season, like, when previous storylines have been wrapped up, and you want to introduce new ones, but you don't really have a way to do that yet, so you just need filler in between. For a premiere, though, I think the object should be to introduce those new longer-term storylines that are going to end up defining the season. And I think spending the majority of your time on something like this, where it's like, it's almost a diversion instead of anything important, I think it kind of takes away from the point of the episode.
Well, we do end up seeing the magical thing get set up in episode two, and I guess it's just a difference of opinion. I can see that. And before we actually, you know, we have more to talk about for episode one. But before we move on into the actual episode itself, I've always thought it was kind of interesting, you know, talking about Gomez really briefly, and I don't want to forget to bring this up. I think there are a lot of people on this show, which is, of course, a drama, that have a pretty substantial background in comedy. And I've read the Wikipedias for many of the people on this cast, and the guy who plays Gomez, from what I understand, is like a Latino late-night host, kind of, you know, like Conan or whatever, but from maybe out in like California or wherever, racist man. But, you know, of course, Bryan Cranston became internationally famous for playing the dad on Malcolm in the Middle. Bob Odenkirk had a show on HBO with David Cross called Mr. Show, and I don't know that he's very well regarded as a comedic actor. Bill Burr, the ginger guy with the beard who, you know, helps out and does all these distractions and everything. The guy everyone knows who I'm talking about is a big time stand up comedian. He's really funny. And then the super morbidly obese guy, Saul's bodyguard, is also a stand up comedian. And I see him on like Chelsea Lately or whatever. I mean, what I mean is I hear he's on that show.
Yeah, I think one of the best things.
Tom doesn't get that. It's embarrassing.
That should be
that
right
show.
Over my head. Yeah. I think one of the best things about Breaking Bad is that all the secondary and tertiary characters do have an important role to play. Like, their role is clearly defined, and the actors that they choose for those roles, they do them very well. Like, I think there are very few characters on the show that you can point to and say, you know, I think the choice of actor for this role is poor or anything like that.
No, not at all. I agree completely. I think honestly, everyone is crushing it in their roles. I think it was Daniel Negreanu, actually, like complaining on Twitter or whatever about many of the leads perhaps overacting, and I really couldn't disagree more. I think everyone knocks it completely out of the park, and they've been rewarded accordingly. With Bryan Cranston's got three or four Emmys, Aaron Paul just got one. I think everyone does a great job.
Yeah, like even when they're choosing completely arbitrary roles, like Villager Number Four or something, even when that's stuff like where it's not a role where you can really play into it at all, like your acting ability doesn't really factor into it much, they still take pains to ensure that those roles aren't deficient to the show in any way. Like, if you see a character, you know that character is important and that character is not going to ruin the show by, you know, misplaying their part or anything like that.
If I can cite an older example, I thought one of the best casting jobs they did was DJ Qualls, that like emaciated looking guy who played the undercover cop in like a season 2 episode, who sets up that sting on Badger in the cold open, where he's like, you have to tell me if you're a cop or whatever, like ask me if I'm a cop or whatever, and I'll have to tell you. And then he says he's not a cop, turns out he is. I think for someone like DJ Qualls, I'd heard of before and seen him in other things. And for obviously to get someone who looks like that, that's people will know who he looks like. He's like 70 pounds or whatever. And of course they want someone against type who doesn't look like they'd be a cop. But I thought even to go that far to the extreme and still have him pull it off completely, I thought was perfect, even though he looks like comically small for the thing. And this, in the same sense that Huel, Saul's bodyguard, looks comically large. I think they still both completely pull it off.
Yeah, or even someone like Old Joe, who we see resurface in this episode, where it's like, if you wrote that part out of the script entirely, I don't think it would really affect the show in any way. And yet the fact that it's there, because it's done so well, adds to the show in almost an intangible way.
Completely. And also, speaking of great characters who add to this show, someone I know you're very excited to start talking about, that, of course, being Mike. What do you have to say about Mike this episode?
Yeah, I'm a big Mike fan. Like, one of the things I was most excited to see coming into season 5 was how big a role Mike would play. Like, would they find a way to quietly ride him out of the show, you know, one or two episodes in, or was he going to step up and play an even bigger role than he did in season 4? And I'm happy to say that it was the latter. Like, I think Jonathan Banks is fantastic in the role. I know he's played similar roles in many other shows before, like cop dramas, that sort of thing, and he really does it to perfection here. Like, because in season 4 we saw Mike as Gus's fixer, who's kind of hard and just running around intimidating people. Here we see new sides to Mike. Like, we see him playing with his granddaughter, we see him talking to Lydia. It's like a lot more texture is added to his character, and I really like seeing that.
Yeah, I think when you decide to write off Gus Fring, you are aware that you are putting a major hole in your lineup in terms of strong, strong, strong characters. And Mike is really filling that gap this season, to the point that I forget about Gus sometimes in terms of missing Gus, which I thought I was going to be thinking about the whole time. Like, oh, I wish Gus had been around for the final season too. And maybe he will. Maybe we'll be getting into that like down the line, about maybe we'll see someone dead like in flashbacks or whatever. But for now, I think Mike is absolutely knocking it out of the park in pretty much every scene he does. And I think Mike is the writers are doing an outstanding job filling that void that I think losing Gus obviously is going to have.
Yeah, definitely. And even stuff like Mike talking to the chickens when we first see him in this episode, just those lines are... I think that's one of the things that differentiates a show like Breaking Bad from maybe some of the lower tier shows, where even some of the less important interactions, some of the less important characters, the focus on them is what really elevates a show like this to the next level. Okay, so one of the aspects of Mike's character that we see focused on this episode is his relationship with Jesse. So what do you think about this? I thought it became like almost paternal at times. I think we really saw in the scene at the beginning where Mike is clearly ready to shoot Walt. He wants to do this. Leaving aside a matter of revenge or whatever, like, I don't think this was a matter of vengeance for Mike. He's clearly tired of all of Walt's bullshit. He wants to put an end to it and just go back to a life of relatively easy retirement. And then when Jesse jumps in the way and says essentially that it's a package deal, like, you either take both of us or none of us, you can see Mike thinking, well, fuck, like, I want to be done with this, but I can't. Like, I still have some kind of, not obligation to Jesse, but there's still, I think, a feeling there that I think was interesting. What do you make of it?
I think you're onto something here, Dom, because Mike does not refuse to shoot a lot of people. I think many people in Mike's situation, if Jesse says you're either going to have to take both of us or kill both of us, a lot of people would say, all right, well, I'm going to kill both of you. So you didn't have to. I could have kept you alive, but apparently not. But no, I think, and I hadn't thought of the paternal thing, but if you'll recall, Jesse does not have a great relationship with his own family. We saw once or twice him go back to his parents' house who were like upper middle class, and he's got that successful younger brother who he later covers for when the brother gets caught with a gun or whatever. But his parents don't seem to really like Jesse. And even after, you know, he buys their house and he's got all, and supporting himself now and everything, we still really never see that come into play. And I think, of course, it's not something that Jesse's never going to think about. And even if it doesn't come up on the show a lot, I think it's still, we can understand why he may still be considering it, because any character would. And this is another one of those things where perhaps he sees that in Mike because he's looking for that in his own father. And even though it's not mentioned a ton on the show, it's still certainly something the character would be going through.
Yeah, and from Mike's side, we see that there's nobody who really plays that corresponding role in his life. Obviously, he has a young granddaughter, but there's no mention of any other children or of a significant other who's still in his life or anything. So Mike seems almost alone. So for him to have someone who he would never outwardly admit is important to him in any way, but I think when he is around someone like Jesse, who he can assume that role towards, I think he's going to do that.
And in season 4, we had that episode where many people were speculating, oh, maybe this is going to be the end of Jesse, when Mike says, we're going for a ride, basically, and takes Jesse, around on his trips to go basically collect from people. And like I said, there was speculation that, oh, Mike's going to go kill Jesse. And instead, we see them form kind of this bond. And ever since then, Mike seems to stick up for the kid.
Yeah, and we have to imagine that Gus was the one who encouraged Mike to work on that relationship, right? It was Mike who was instructed with the task of prying Jesse away from Walt. And he had to have chosen Mike for the role because he thought that he was suited to doing that for some reason, despite the fact that he has this tough exterior.
Well, I like the conclusion of that scene is Mike holding his hand out and demanding the keys, which really is the universal sign for throw me the keys. Yeah, I mean, gauging by your response, maybe the universal sign for throw me the keys in England is your left hand.
No, surprisingly, we do have keys and hands over here in England. I just wasn't sure what more I could add to. All right, so we see Walt and Mike argue about what's the best way to retrieve the information that's on Gus's laptop. And here we see a theme which I was kind of confused to see, which is Jesse seems to become more competent and almost like the voice of reason throughout the season, where Mike and Walt are bickering over some minor dispute and Jesse is the one that comes up with the answer, and he seems more calm and rational in the process than either of them.
Oh, yeah, totally. And this is something we're definitely going to be getting to. And of course, because this is the first instance of where we see this. And this is why I think another reason that you can't really write off this premiere as something that, oh, we didn't really get anything out of. Because I think there's certainly a possibility, given how much we know Vince Gilligan likes to go back on premieres and say, and when you look back and say, oh my God, it was so obvious he left it right there for us the whole time. I think this could be totally something like that. And I think this development as Jesse as a character could be, maybe there's some switch that we saw get flipped that we don't yet realize was a switch getting flipped in Jesse. And this is where we're first starting to see the results of that.
Yeah, the thing that worries me, though, is that we're never really given an indication of what that thing might be. Like, all of a sudden, Jesse turns from the kid who knew nothing about science, didn't pay attention to it in school, was mocked by the cartel's chemist for not being able to synthesize the acid last season, to someone who seemingly knows more about physics than Mike and Walt combined, given that Walt was a science teacher.
Right, because one of the things is we know that Walt knew Jesse before he was like a meth or whatever, you know, meth addict, basically. Because he was his high school teacher, and I feel like if they had planned on this from the whole time, then at some point, back when they were first talking, like back first striking up, hooking up, that Walt would have said something along the lines of like, come on, I always knew you were smarter than you acted in class or whatever, but I don't believe we ever got anything like that.
Yeah, I think they're trying to turn Jesse into the competent one of the group to differentiate him from Walt and Mike, who I think Walt at least is definitely meant to be seen as a villain. I think by distancing Jesse from that, they're portraying Jesse more positively. However, I think there's a way to do that without adding aspects of Jesse's personality that not only weren't there before, but that we were actively encouraged to not think were there. Stuff like, you know, how does Jesse know all this stuff about trains randomly to the point where he's able to perfectly conduct the operation in episode 5 with putting the water in and taking the methamine out? This is something which you wouldn't expect him to be able to do. And similarly here, like, why would Jesse come across the idea of magnets before Walt? It just doesn't make any sense.
This scene struck me as false for the same reason that the scene in that Kevin Costner movie 21 where about the MIT blackjack card counting team, the scene that always ran in the promos was the Monty Hall problem, where it basically by switching doors you gain an extra 30%, and this is supposed to be a Harvard math class where the whole class is stumped on that except this one kid, where it's like, come on, give me a break. Everyone would immediately put this together. And for that, by that same logic, it seems to me like as I was sitting there, the only way I could even think of if I needed to wipe a hard drive that I've ever heard of is with magnets, and it seems like Walt would be on that immediately, certainly before Jesse would get on that.
Yeah, so maybe that is a case of it not being entirely implausible that Jesse would come up with that, but it certainly is implausible that Walt would not come up with it first.
Well, thank you for saying, since I could come up with it, that Jesse, the dumb guy, could thus then come up with it. Thanks, Tom.
That wasn't what I was implying, but if you want to take it that way, then fine.
I'm just trying to make good podcasts here, Tom.
any chance to insult you accidentally is one I'm going to take out for sure.
Definitely. And now, of course, we mentioned seeing old Joe again, but I was really happy to see old Joe. Of course, the only other time we saw him was one of my favorite episodes that we've ever seen, where Walt and Jesse are stuck in the RV as Hank's coming, trying to break into it to catch whoever's cooking all this stuff. But he doesn't have a warrant, and Jesse says, you know, this is my own private domicile, and I will not be harassed, bitch.
Yeah, that was great. I think old Joe gets outshadowed by everyone else in that scene, just because that scene was done so well. But it's definitely worth noting that old Joe carried his weight there and here as well.
Oh, for sure. I think that guy's fed. I actually read his Wikipedia the other day, too. But I'm sure people are really dying to know whose Wikipedias I have and have not read.
Does he have a background in comedy by any chance?
Actually, the next thing I want to talk about is actually somewhat related to that, which is because we see the return of Ted Beneke, who had previously been kind of like shaken down and kind of intimidated by Bill Burr and Huell. And Ted is someone who, when I saw the opening credits, I saw Christopher Cousins' name, and that's the actor who plays Ted. So I, of course, was aware that, okay, we're going to see Ted again. And I thought to myself, I'm actually kind of hoping that potentially we could see David Costabile and Giancarlo Esposito's names in these credits, who played Gale and Gus, respectively. So, Dom, I want to ask you, and we hit on this a bit earlier, what would you think about if we saw, like, some of the characters we now know die in the ultimate plot, came back for, like, flashbacks or whatever?
I think it would depend on who those characters were, but I trust the editors not to just bring back dead characters on a whim for no reason. I think if they are going to bring back, they're going to bring back people like Gus or whoever who do have a role to play in the story. And I think we've seen last season examples of when they've used characters in flashbacks, and I think it's been done pretty well. And I'd be perfectly happy if, say, in a few episodes' time, we see a flashback involving Gus that somehow adds to our knowledge of the story.
Yeah, totally. And I, you know, historically speaking, I would lean no towards having dead characters come back and to get briefly into The Wire again. A lot of people, not to get into specifics, but a lot of people die on The Wire. They get killed. Big surprise.
Yeah, see, I knew that.
Right. But when someone dies on The Wire, they do not come back. They're fucking dead and that's it. And that kind of finality of death really adds to the impact of the show, because some major characters die on that show in some early seasons, and you're like, okay, that's legit it for this character that I've spent the last however many episodes getting to know. And I think that adds a ton in terms of connecting with the characters, like, oh my god, this character is gone now.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at, and I have a point to make, but I'm struggling to think of the right way to say it, so I apologize if this comes out kind of weird. I think what we're talking about on The Wire is that when a character dies, it's like they've been removed from the story altogether. Like, one of the themes that runs throughout a show like The Wire is, once you're dead, nobody cares. Like, that's a harsh reality of life. Like, you're dead, and that's what happens.
That's correct.
A show like Breaking Bad, the finality of death, or however you want to express it, isn't really something that they need to emphasize. So when they can bring back characters for, you know, in specific scenes to add to the current storyline they're trying to create. The fact that they're dead isn't an obstacle to that in the same way that it would be on a show like The Wire.
Well, isn't the whole premise of Breaking Bad the idea that if Walt dies, Skyler and the rest of the family have nothing?
Well, yeah, but I think it's like, on The Wire, given you have this like preponderance of characters which all have a role to play in the story, like, it's more even, I get the impression at least, on a show like Breaking Bad, where you have this clear lineup of primary characters, and then there's some who are less important but still have important parts to play, and then there are ones who are just in the background in their own specific niches. On Breaking Bad, if any of those tertiary characters die, then you can't use that death to make a point about the storyline that's being advanced, or like a meta point about the show in general. Because I think on The Wire, like, if a character dies, it hits home at some of the themes that they're trying to express, such as, you know, this is what life is like in a place like Baltimore, or something like that, where people just die indiscriminately, and it's not fair, and it's not fun, and it just happens to people, and people have to deal with the consequences of that. With here, you can't really discuss, well, what happens if Saul dies? Is everyone suddenly going to care? Probably not. They're going to find someone who replaces him in that role and move on. Like, they can't use it for the same functions they can on a show of that sort.
As they say on The Wire, when it comes to death, deserves got nothing to do with it. Okay, and so the next thing I want to move on to is what I think is kind of a telling quote out of Walt in terms of character development, which is when he's arguing about Mike, or arguing with Mike about whether or not this magnet plan is going to work, and Mike's saying, I don't know, how do we know, how can we possibly be sure? And Walt comes back with, because I say so. Which, of course, is a very boss quote, and I think this kind of is serving to set Walt up as we see him go on, you know, getting back into, like, full Heisenberg mode, where he's really feeling like he is the guy now.
Yeah, and I think it sets up a nice contrast between Walt, the professional chemist who we saw at the start of season one, and now the Walt, as we see him here, who just has no care for the practicalities of what he's discussing. Like, Mike is raising a valid point. Like, how are we supposed to do this properly? And Walt doesn't care. Like, he expects people to just trust what he says and not be concerned with what the reality of the situation is.
I think if I can defend Walt here, if Vince Gilligan says to me the end of Breaking Bad is going to be outstanding, and I say, how do I know that? And he says, because I say so. I'm going to take his word there, because it's been 4.5 seasons of outstanding stuff. And similarly with Walt, it's been 4.5 seasons of him coming up with the right solutions no matter what they are. And so I could kind of dig this if I'm saying, if Walt says to me, I know this is going to work because I know it's going to work, that's fine enough for me.
Well, I don't know that it has been 4 seasons of Walt coming up with the right solutions. I mean, I don't think there's any reading of the show on which that's a...
Given whatever mistakes he makes, he can manage to get himself out of those mistakes.
Yeah, but this is a different... And this is why that analogy doesn't work, which is Vince Gilligan and the show's writers have a proven track record of getting things right in the show. And we can question minor things, like... As I kind of implied before, I don't think the ending of season 2 was particularly well done, and you know, that I didn't like the premiere of this season particularly, but these are minor things in the grand scheme of things. Like, if you said to someone, these are the worst things about Breaking Bad, that's a good thing to be able to say about the show. Whereas with Walt, the fact that his actions have resulted in the needless death of a number of people, and the fact that this entire thing is unnecessary because he was given multiple escape routes back in season 1, like ways in which this could have been peacefully resolved from the beginning, is like, I think anyone who understands the route that Walt took to get here would have many, many reasons to doubt how he's going to continue.
Well, I think you can say that it could have been peacefully resolved with the end result if he goes back to just being a high school chemistry teacher, which of course is not why if he's going to be doing this, it's not so he can go end up doing that again.
Right, but if you're on Mike's position here, you have just...
Oh, if you're in Mike's... Well, things change, as we'll get to. When you're in Mike's position now, he wants to stop because he thinks he's got $2 billion in his granddaughter's name. And then, of course, we end up seeing when Hank and Gomi take that away from him in episode 3, I think, that's when he starts getting back on board with this.
Right, but this is all kind of tangential to the point, which is, if you're Mike, you have evidence on which to think that Walt is someone who cares more about having things his own way than he does about actually coming up with the correct solution to a problem. And this, like, Walt's reaction to that worry is further proof of that assumption.
Okay, and, you know... do you want to keep going on that?
Well, okay, I want to talk about Ted a bit more, actually, because
okay.
I think when we saw the scene in Ted's house where Kubi and Hul come in and intimidate him and he goes and trips his head and bangs his head on the table, I think everyone assumed at that point that he was dead, or most people did at least. So the fact that he comes back here in the premiere, if only briefly, was surprising to a lot of people. Do you think that was a good decision on the writer's part? I mean, how did you react to it?
It's interesting because the end result is him just confirming to Skyler that he's going to stay silent. What's really the point in bringing him back? So for me, it kind of might indicate Ted might start talking later.
I don't think it necessarily implies that. I kind of liked seeing Ted again because obviously the show is mainly focused on Walt and his process of Breaking Bad, but I think one of the points about that is that it necessarily involves everyone else, and the negative consequences spread, and one of those is that everyone else kind of skirts the line when it comes to their own moral decisions. And so the way that relates to Skyler is one of the things she's had to do is lie to the IRS about Ted's finances, and that sets in motion the whole chain of events that leads to Ted being in this situation. And even if you can make a case that she isn't the one ultimately responsible for that, she seemed to think that she is. And so I think reintroducing Ted here was a nice way to reemphasize that, look, this is how this whole thing has affected Skyler beyond the fact that her husband's now a meth cook and has put her and her whole family in danger.
That's an interesting theory. So Ted may be there more so we can understand a bit more about Skyler, because it's, not to keep harping on this, it seems like Chekhov's Ted to me, where if we're going to see Ted was just as well might have been dead, and if he's going to come back in, why? What's the point if it's not going to end up having any result? Although I do like your idea that it's to further show us why Skyler's in this kind of state of panic.
Yeah, well, I think it has to relate to Skyler in some way, because we've never got to know anything about Ted independent of his relationship with Skyler. Like, even when we learned about him as a businessman or whatever, it was all as part of the storyline that, okay, Skyler ends up being involved in this, in these criminal dealings, and ends up having to come up with this radical way to deal with it. And also, I think this is different than something like the cold open we see where Walt buys a gun, because I think if you put the scene of Walt buying the gun in and then don't resolve that in some way later down the road, people will legitimately ask, well, why include that scene at all? Whereas I think if we never saw Ted again after episode 1, people would understand and there wouldn't really be anything unresolved to deal with later.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would argue with that is why even bring him back in episode 1? Yeah, okay. Right, it's just the same idea.
For the reason that I gave,
right,
which is,
yeah.
Like, obviously, if they want to emphasize, like, the way that this is affecting Skyler, and they want to relate that to Ted, they have to do more than just say in the previously on Breaking Bad, or last season on Breaking Bad, oh, by the way, Skyler and Ted end up doing this or whatever. But this is a nice concrete way to show that, and remind people, given that everything that happened last season.
All right. Well, I'm of the opinion there's going to be something more to that. So we'll see. And now, you know, Mike's not the only one trying to talk Walt and Jesse out of going back into business. Of course, our good buddy Saul is also there saying, "Hey guys, let's close up shop here and call it a life on the whole meth cooking thing. You're lucky to be alive. Let's just let's make a clean break here."
Yeah, and here we see one of the lines which I actually liked most in the episode, randomly, which was, after Saul gives him the whole pitch, Walt says, "You're not Clarence Darrow, Saul," which is a fine exclamation point in the argument, because it's true. Like, Saul can't really reply to that. You can't take lessons on morality and proper business ethics from Saul.
Yeah, Claire, I actually led myself to the Wikipedia for the Scopes trial after seeing your notes on that line. Yeah, I always love because, you know, Clarence Darrow, of course, was the one who defended Scopes for teaching evolution, and Walt's implying, you know, look, you're not some champion of morality here. You're a crooked two-bit guy or whatever he calls him. And I always love the juxtaposition of that with every scene, I think, that's ever taken place in Saul's office has had the scales of justice right on his desk. And I was like sitting in between the two characters. I always love that, especially when you factor in that when working in the line of dealing drugs, you're often weighing quite a bit, like getting the yield or whatever.
Yeah, that is the same principle where if you visit the office of like an evangelist, con artist or whatever, they're always going to have some big tacky plastic cross on their desk. It's like,
yeah, he's got like the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or whatever plastered across his wall,
like, laminated in like large pink font or whatever. Yeah, it's like if you have to see a symbol of the profession there, you know that they're probably not performing it very well.
I want to see. Do we know? I think she's still doing fine, and she's not dead or anything. Saul's assistant, because now we see Huel a lot, but I really liked her. You know, she was the one who in that episode, that first episode with the junkyard. Called Hank's cell phone and pretended to be 911 saying Marie was dead or whatever. I always, you know, I always like it when they have these people, you know, we're seeing it now with Todd, where these people who for money will just do whatever. And I think that always adds a nice little element, especially when it's in the Saul department. I think there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, definitely.
Huel may not have the same skill set that woman might have.
No, I think that's fair to say. Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing her again either, but I don't think it's something that you need to force. Like, there's no reason to just write her in for the sake of it. If there's something where Saul needs to have some assistance for whatever reason, then fine, but I don't think warping a scene to include her is really productive at all.
Yeah, sure. And then this episode ends up with, if you're cool on Saul, with Walt and Skyler once again, and this is, I couldn't make it out at first, but I understand now. He says, I forgive you. And this is, I would equate this to, first of all, he's less audible than you tend to be on this quote, and I can't believe they went with that for the final cut. Yeah, sigh all you want. But it's good because as unintelligible as you tend to be, you've become, through your skills to poor enunciation, what pharmacists are to like reading bad handwriting, where they're so used to it that they can do it, and it becomes a skill.
I'm not sure if that's like a compliment or a backhanded insult, or
it's a backhanded compliment.
Okay, then fine. Yeah, so this was the first of two rather menacing Walt Scholar scenes we see in the first two episodes, just at the end. And I like the fact actually that they're reserved just for the very end because it keeps it like lingering in the viewer's mind after the episode ends. Thinking like the tension between Walt and Scarlet is obviously going to be a major theme of the remaining episodes of Breaking Bad, and I think having these kind of very short but very deep scenes at the end is a nice way of like installing that without having to take a lot of time out of earlier in the episode.
Yeah, I think one of the problems perhaps with some of the earlier seasons, and maybe some of the with so much action going on now with Walt, Mike, and Jesse really starting like their own little co-op. Is that Skyler may get lost in the mix here, and I think it's nice having these scenes with, okay, we see Walt as Heisenberg doing his cooking and doing his dealing and being a badass, and then we see Walt the family guy, and I think these scenes, like you said, with Skyler are all brilliant, and I think having one or two per episode really helps show all the dimensions of Walt.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like Skyler as a character, although I think some of those roles have been laid in the past few episodes where I think Skyler and Anna Gunn portraying Skyler has put on a bravura performance, to be honest. But I think a lot of people objected to the character because they felt like putting the focus on her detracted from the focus of Walt, and people tune in to see Walt. Like, Walt is the main protagonist who's driving all the storylines and stuff. And so I like having less of Skyler as, like, an independent character and more of Skyler as a vehicle for conveying a point about Walt.
Okay, I can dig that. I'm into Skyler as a character for a weird reason, because I want to know, actually, this is a question I've been wanting to ask you. Because one thing that that goes through my mind is where I think each of these people is going to draw their own personal line. So Dom, knowing that Skyler has encountered the pink teddy bear eyeball and everything, and now that she's getting kind of become okay with being involved in this drug trade, over under 0.5 murders committed by Skyler, as in true or false, she will kill someone at some point during the series.
I think it's more likely that she gets killed during the series than she actually kills anybody. I just don't think that's the direction in which her character's heading. I think it would be kind of cheap to have a character end up like that. I'm not sure how they could plausibly make her end up doing that. I think her character's just fine as it is. I don't think they need to dramatically amp up the role that she plays in order to lead to something like that.
Yeah, if I can make, I'm sure there's a big crossover in interest between Breaking Bad and musical theater, like at Grease, at the end of Grease, when Sandy suddenly becomes like the bad chick who wears all the leather or whatever, it really rings false for the character, and I'm actually with you here. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that it's more likely she dies than she kills someone. I would say it's more likely she kills someone than she dies, but I don't think either is going
to
happen.
Yeah, to return to your question, I think she's already begun to draw that own personal line where she said, look, I can handle the consequences of being with Walt and committing myself to being in some kind of partnership with him, even though she's doing so in a state of duress. But she's not going to let that impact her children. And I think when she does feel like they are in legitimate danger, I think that is the point at which she's going to consider blowing up everything that she's been involved in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I can dig that. We've definitely seen her say on more than one occasion that she's not going to let the kids get mixed in here.
Right, I think one possible endgame for Skylar's character is that she's going to have to decide, well, do I turn on Walt and give him in, or do I stick with him and suffer the possible consequences of that?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that could totally be what we see end up happening there.
Okay, so do you want to move on to episode 2?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so episode 2 starts, as every episode does, with a cold open, and I thought this one was really interesting, actually. So this is something which is unlike one that we've seen before on the show, and it's unlike anything that occurs later in the actual episode. It seems to be kind of unrelated to everything that happens. But in a way, I felt the episode was better for it having been there. So just to recap it quickly, we see someone who soon identified as Herr Schuler, someone high up at Magical Electromotive, the corporation that was the one supposedly behind Gus's operation in the US. And we see him in one of the other, like, aspects of that company's dealings, which is it's just a normal food business. Like, even though Los Pollos Manos was a front for the drug trade in Albuquerque, like, it was a legitimate restaurant even beyond that. And like, so we get to see part of that operation where this guy is testing some of the sauces and stuff that they're going to be using in the restaurant. So we see that drag on for a bit, and then he's informed that the police are here to see him, and because he knows what that means, like, there's no reason for the police to be here unless they think that he's involved in something suspicious, and there's only one thing that could be. He knows that the jig is up now, and so what we see is he goes into the bath, electrocuting himself to death with a defibrillator, collapses on the floor, and the last scene before the credits is him lying on the floor while the toilet flushes behind him and the cops and his secretary are outside the door, which I thought was a fitting way to end that scene. Like, what do you think of it?
First of all, I was super psyched because this guy, Herr Schuler, looked like he could be like a classic bad guy, and I was really psyched to start getting to hate some Germans, because I think that's a lost art form in terms of making the Germans the bad guys. We're so caught up now in making random Islamic countries the bad guys in all of our movies, and then it was the Russians for a long time. I really like the Germans really got to make a comeback here, although it looks like we're probably not going to end up getting to see much more of that. Of course, he ends up killing himself, and now we're left basically with just Lydia. But yeah, I thought this was very interesting, and I thought, like I said, I thought this was going to have more of a role to play. But I'm with you that while we don't necessarily know a ton too much about that, I'm glad that it existed in the sense that we can see, okay, everyone who now knows that Gus is dead and knows that perhaps things are going to start crumbling, these people are all in panic mode. Like when he's sitting there tasting all the dipping sauces, the guy's explaining each of them to him, and he's not even paying attention. He's just casually going and interrupting the guy. The guy's trying to describe one to him, and he's just immediately on to the next one. And it's really like this guy doesn't care. He knows he's just a big ball of nerves right now.
Yeah, you could see this look of weariness on his face while he was doing it. Like, he was clearly not focusing on what he was doing, but it seemed like there's also something external which was really hanging on his mind. And
right, and to expand on that, I think it's kind of, it serves to represent everyone who was at least partially involved or, you know, was in the know on Gus's whole operation, because now that they see the news that Gus is dead and that he's been discovered as this big crime or drug lord, that their names could start coming up very quickly. And I think this guy, this whole opening sequence really served to demonstrate that these people are now kind of walking on eggshells at best. And we see it again with Lydia.
Yeah.
when Hank is interrogating her. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, the main embodiment of that is, of course, Lydia, who, it seems like her jitteriness is a function of her personality as well, more than anything. But all, and obviously, there's going to be more focus on her because she's the one who survives the episode and is ends up playing a big role in what goes on. But I think it's also interesting that they, I like that they showed that on the part of Herr Schuler as well, because he's like the classic taciturn German who doesn't really show his emotions outwardly. And so the fact that he is clearly distressed about this, it shows that this is something which has really penetrated to the heart of the operation. Like, everyone is legitimately worried about this now.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we see, you know, he has that picture in his office of he and Gus. That is, like, I think it serves as a nice example for everyone just waiting for the whole tower to come to collapse.
Yeah, and to talk about the scene itself and the abstract a bit more, I think it shows confidence on the writer's part that they feel able to include the scene, which is so weirdly different from everything else that comes after it and precedes it, that I think it's good that they felt able to do that without hurting the show in any way. Like, they felt comfortable enough with that scene by itself and with the rest of the show that they felt like merging the two wouldn't harm either of them noticeably.
Yeah, I guess basically, long story short, the scene may not on paper make a ton of sense, but we're glad they put it in. So the next thing we see, actually, is this incident with the ricin where Jesse's now flipping out, thinking that he's the one who's poisoned Brock, kind of not intentionally, of course. And Walt is now, in Walt fashion, trying to figure out a way to kind of set Jesse's mind at ease. What do you think about how this all went down?
Okay, well, to discuss that little subplot more generally, I didn't really like the way in which it was brought into the end of season 4. Like, I thought that whole storyline was kind of contrived. But the fact that they felt the need to continue that at the end of season 4 and to bring it back now at the beginning of season 5 shows that it is definitely going to resurface at some point. Maybe even not in this half of the final series, but it's going to be relevant at some point. Like, they could very easily have just shown Walt throwing it down the toilet or in the garbage, and that would have been that. Like, that would have been resolved, no loose ends, it would have been fine. The fact that they took pains to show him concealing it behind the plug and then leading Jesse on this wild goose chase to make him think that it had been taken out of circulation, it made it clear that this is going to be something which we're going to have to keep thinking about.
Right, definitely, because what I was about to say is, as far as we know, it's still there behind his bedstand.
Right, so it made it clear that this is a tool that Walt can use potentially in the future if he feels the need to off someone.
Yeah, and spoiler alert, when the season 5 promotional posters came out before the first episode of season 5 aired, one of them was just a giant picture of a plant, of a white plant that just said Lily of the Valley. So I'm very much anticipating seeing this come into play again.
Yeah, we see when he's clearing up the first episode, which is a bit that we didn't talk about, but basically one of the first things we see is Walt essentially clearing up all the evidence of the Brock poisoning.
So
we see him taking the plant, jamming it into his boot, and just sweeping up everything that's on the kitchen countertop. And then we see the continuation of that here, where he deals with the final bit of that puzzle, which is the ricin.
That one other thing I thought about this scene is Jesse in the beginning was kind of, you know, the first couple seasons was just this erratic guy, and then season 3 like goes to rehab and gets clean and is just not emotional and just staring forward all the time and never talking, and now he seems to have become this guy who really cares about people, like, for instance, caring enough about Walt to jump in front of Mike and not let him shoot him, or about right now with Brock, like, wanting to clear his conscience about all this stuff, and it seems like a totally different Jesse, and this kind of touches back to what we were talking about before, which is I feel like the motivation for this is a bit unclear, and all I can really think about it is maybe it's his relationship with Andrea. Maybe this experience where he's thinking perhaps he had something to do with Brock.
Yeah, what did you make of the whole storyline with Jesse and Andrea? Because I thought, again, like when you're, if you're the writers and at the end of season 4, you want to do this thing where you have this worry about the ricin cigarette being used to poison Brock and all of this thing. You have to involve Andrew and Brock back in the storyline again. And so, given the fact that you can't really write them off in season 4, they have to then be brought back for season 5, and you then have to deal with them there somehow. So do you think that they're going to have some enduring relevance after this, or when we see Jesse break up with Andrew in episode 3, to jump ahead a bit, do you think this is the end of the road for that?
I don't think it's completely the end of the road for Andrea. I think what we're going to see is Jesse maybe have kind of like an adverse response to that, and maybe down the line if he needs some kind of like grounding or whatever, maybe Andrea comes back in and he sees Brock, maybe he sees them out in town or whatever, and it sudden all these emotions rush back to him. If we need kind of like a sudden change of pace from Jesse, I could see Andrea being used as a tool a few episodes down the line for that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they keep choosing to bring up all of his examples of manipulation of Jesse from season 4, where they could have easily just put that all in the past and come up with new material that led to some rift between them down the line. I think the fact that they chose to do that suggests that they want that to factor into the explanation for why Jesse will end up splitting up, presumably quite soon. I think it's probably going to happen during the season 5 finale. Probably not before that, but definitely by then, I think.
This part 1 finale or part 2?
Part 1 finale.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, definitely. Well, the other thing is, like we talked about before, they're not doing this on accident. Whatever reason they have, it's for a reason of some kind, and I think we may just not even see it right yet.
Right. You could argue that maybe the writers kind of backed themselves into a spot where they had to write themselves out of it somehow, and they felt that this was just the best way of doing that. But I gave them enough credit to have a reason for including every scene that they include. I think the fact that they think this was a worthwhile thing to come back to shows that they felt this was the best way of accomplishing something that needed to be accomplished in the story.
Sure.
And it's unclear to me exactly what that thing would be, but that's the motivation, definitely, I think.
Yeah, and it totally sounds like such a cop-out answer for me when I go, oh, well, we might not just get it, and maybe we'll get it down the line or whatever, and leaving the door open, which I guess it is, but I still think there's to discount that, and I think we should not only not discount it, but expect that there are going to be a lot of things that we're talking about today that when everything's said and done, we're going to look back and be like, oh my God, this was all so clear if we had somehow known the clues or whatever.
Right, and I think that's another aspect of what makes a great show, which is when you're done with it and you're going back and rewatching, you see everything fit into the puzzle much earlier, and it allows you to see the show in a new light. Like, so the show is both good as someone who's seeing it for the first time and for someone who knows what's going on and is able to sit back and enjoy it for what it really is.
Definitely. Now, the next thing that we see very briefly, and I didn't even notice it, but Mike is, tending to his bullet wounds, and he's watching The Caine Mutiny, which is an old Humphrey Bogart movie. Do you know, and I know Vince Gilligan was talking about this, do you know anything about this? Because apparently it might have some parallels with Walt.
Yeah, I didn't, but apparently, yeah, the story in The Caine Mutiny is basically the story of what's playing out on Breaking Bad. And this is one of the more obvious examples of symbolism on the show where it's not obvious if you don't get it. Like, if you haven't seen The Caine Mutiny before, then you just think, well, Mike's watching TV. But if you do understand the reference, then it's clearly apparent what that's indicating.
Well, it's kind of like later down the line when they're watching Scarface, which is a much more, I would say, much more recognizable film. And by the way, spoiler alert on The Caine Mutiny, if you wanted to watch that and haven't had the opportunity yet since, like, it came out in 1954.
But, yeah, I think Scarface is more obvious, not only because many more people have seen it, but also because, like, even if you haven't seen it before, the fact that there is loud gunfire sounds coming from the TV, and Walt then goes on to say, everybody dies in this movie, don't they? Like, that is, they couldn't, if they hit you over the head with a hammer, it wouldn't be more obvious.
But, yeah, I also would say, Scarface, that scene in Scarface has got to be one of the top five most recognizable scenes in movie history. The Say Hello to My Little Friend.
Right. Well,
it's not number one.
I haven't seen it, so I wouldn't know, but I've got to take your word for that.
No, nor have I, but I've certainly seen that scene. And I understand that it's, you know, Tony Montana is a drug lord who kills a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think you can safely predict that in Breaking Bad, people are going to die. Like, it's not going to end with Walt ends up making lots of money for his family, and they live happily ever after, and kittens and rainbows and all this kind of stuff.
All right, well, fair enough. Well, speaking of Hank, actually, the next big thing we see is back at Hank's at the DEA office, the guy, you know, the boss man, Merkert, ends up getting fired because Hank was telling him the whole time, look, Gus Fring's the one running this, and he was saying, no, he's not. And then when Gus Fring ends up being the one running it, of course, someone, as Merkert puts it, someone had to go under the bus, and thus Merkert's fired, and it's looking like good things are going to happen for Hank here.
Yeah, I think the significance of this scene is that I think most of the time when we watch Breaking Bad, we're being shown the intricacies of the drug world, and so I think there's a natural tendency to assume that whatever happens in that world stays in that world. Like, all the deaths that we see tend to be within that world, and so it's very jarring when we see how it actually has ripples out towards real life, right? Outside of that. So, for instance, when Jane ends up dying because of Walt's negligence and Jesse's drug taking, everything like that. And then her father goes and crashes the plane, which leads to more deaths. And then, like, I think whenever the show shows you the real life consequences of the actions that people take, it helps add like this kind of gravity to them. It shows you that they're not just contained within their own little bubble, like insulated from everything that's going on outside.
Yeah, and also, of course, the other interesting thing to come out of this scene is the story that Merkert ends up telling about how he was friends with Gus Fring, despite, you know, being a DEA agent, and Gus was a big friend of, like, the police officer. You know, he was one of the biggest donors, like, hiding in plain sight to law enforcement. And Merkert's talking about how, like, Gus would come over for dinner, and he taught him how the best way to cook fish, and he still uses Gus's fish cooking technique, and how Gus was just right under his nose the whole time, which, of course, the savvy viewer will take note that this draws quite the parallel between the relationship between Walt and Hank, where they're, you know, brothers-in-law and very good friends, and Walt's just right under Hank's nose the whole time.
Well, yeah, it's also a nice reminder of just how badass Gus was as well. Like,
yeah,
this almost psychopathic ability to just lie to your face and have everyone totally convinced that you're best friends with them.
Oh, I thought you were talking about his badass culinary skills.
Well, that as well. I saw a piece of speculation where they said that Hank was going to catch Walt because they were going to be at some event together, and Walt was going to fold like the fish in the fish packet in the same way, and Hank was going to see that, and suddenly it would all come together in his mind, and like he's had this revelation, which I think that would legitimately be jumping the shark if that happened.
What I was thinking along the same lines, I was having a conversation the other day about Jesse's brilliant use of the word bitch. And, of course, that same scene where in the junkyard where he says to Hank, you know, this is my own private domicile and I will not be harassed, bitch, that at some point down the line, he knows that this Pinkman kid is up to no good or whatever, and he sees Walt with Jesse, and Jesse ends up yelling out something about it just off the cuff, not at Hank, but they're all just in the same place, and Jesse ends some yell at someone with bitch, and Hank suddenly has this flashback and rushes and does all the math and can figure, oh my God, Walt knows all this chemistry and everything. And the two cell phones and everything starts adding up. And I thought that may be a legitimate way. Like, I could easily see that being a clue. It's not like everyone ends every sentence with bitch.
Yeah, I mean, we are being kind of facetious here, but I think it does raise an interesting point, which is, at some point, Hank is going to realize what just everything that's been going on. How do you think that revelation is going to take place? Because I think it would be kind of cheap if, after everything that's happened, he sees one small clue and all of a sudden a light flashes in his head and everything comes together. Like, I think this has to be like a more gradual process that leads to some big thing happening which fundamentally alters the way in which Hank sees the entire case.
Do you think that you would not be satisfied unless it's something like Hank catching Walt in the act? Like Walt in like full Heisenberg attire or whatever?
I think it could be something like, for instance, we see Hank investigating like Gus's offshore accounts and stuff. Like if he found something which linked him to Walt, then I could see that being a good way of tying that together. I think it's going to be more dramatic than that though. Like, I think it would be almost an unsatisfactory ending, almost anticlimactic if, you know, Hank sees a piece of paper which ties Gus and Walt together and thinks, well, that's bad. Oh, Gurmy, look at this. My brother-in-law is involved in all this shit. Obviously, Hank would make it more dramatic than that. But I think there has to be like this physical togetherness between Hank and Walt at which this realization actually takes place for it to have like the full meaning that that scene could have.
For me, I feel like, honestly, Hank really hasn't shown me anything that he's even on to Walt yet. And I do agree, and I'll get, you know, I honestly think, and I've been rethinking this the more time I've spent on it, I thought initially that the end of part one of season five would be the big reveal of Hank finally catching Walt. I now think that's going to get delayed until part two. I don't think we're going to see that until part two, because I don't think we can really get 8 episodes out of Hank against Walt. However, well, I think, well, if I, I don't want to forget this. I think Hank isn't even close to being on Walt yet. For instance, before I even saw an episode of the show, whatever, I guess it was when I was watching the pilot, and I heard that this main character's name was Walter White, the first thing I thought was, that sounds a lot like Walt Whitman. And then when he finds the book with Walt Whitman, Gail's leftover notebook documenting all the stuff he was doing in the lab, and he has when I heard The Learned Astronomer, the poem, talking about Walt Whitman and the WW, I swear to you, anytime if I'm in Hank's position and I have a brother-in-law named Walter White, anytime I see Walt Whitman, I'm going to think, I'm going to do the math there, and I seriously think, if Hank sees the initials WW, he's got to immediately jump to Walter White. So for him to not even be considering any of that, to not even be remotely on to Walt by any indication that we've seen, really strikes me as weird at this point. And I think that's why it's going to get put off a little bit.
Yeah, I think that the writers are throwing away an element of realism in order to have this almost like an insider joke with the audience. And I think this is one thing that a lot of shows do effectively, where it's like, the clues are very obvious to the audience who get to see them, like, presented to them as a dispassionate observer. And so when they see Hank with the seemingly obvious stuff in front of him, and he's failing to make the what seems to be, like, a very small leap between realizing that it's Walt that's responsible for this, like, as an audience, you're more drawn in because you think, like, why isn't this happening? Like, you almost become, like, personally invested in seeing Hank actually capture Walt. Or what evade Hank, depending on what outcome you want to see. So I think if you don't think about it very carefully, it seems like kind of careless writing. Like, why do they do that? This isn't realistic. But I think there is a purpose behind it.
Well, the issue I would take with that is Hank is, on one hand, not able to piece together this information about Walt. At the same time, he is able to piece together this stuff that everyone else in the police department wasn't able to work out about Gus Fring and everything, and he seems to be like this very good detective. It seems like at a certain point he would have considered this.
That's fair. But I think there is a truth about human psychology where, you know, Hank has known Walt for, I assume it must have been a few decades now, or at least like 10, 15 years maybe. I think it's very difficult to him for him to separate the facts of the case from the picture that he's had in his head for so long of this family man who hasn't really taken any risks before he took up gambling, but that was just like some random thing that happened to him when he went out of control, and now he's kind of back on the rails. So I think it's perfectly understandable for him to have this blind spot with regard to Walt, where he's failing to piece it together, where if it had been anyone else, then he would have made that jump by now.
Right, yeah, if he didn't know Walt personally, he said, oh, there's this guy who's a brilliant chemist with the initials WW.
Right.
Whose
school had lab equipment that could have been used to make meth, stolen from it, who he knows has had someone who has been dragged into the suspect, Jesse Pinkman, in his class. Is like, these are all seemingly obvious clues, but I think, I don't think it's unrealistic for Hank not to be able to bring all that together. And come to
also because as he's moving forward in all of these cases, he's telling Walt about all of it and giving Walt the heads up on everything he's going to need to do to cover himself.
Yeah, I think subconsciously it's like, I think even if Hank had entertained the idea that it might have been Walt, it's like it's almost embarrassing for him if he fails to spot exactly what's under his nose. So he tries to like convince himself that it couldn't actually be true, that Walt, there's some idea that maybe Walt couldn't have had or something that makes it certain that Walt couldn't be tied to this in any way, so that he looks less embarrassed less when it actually does turn out to be Walt.
Well, I think your defense is a perfectly acceptable defense there, which is, I've known this guy for 15 years, this would be so far out of his character. Although it seems like also he would know about the timing with Walt perhaps dying soon and maybe lashing out a little bit and doing weird things, making weird speeches in front of the high school, for instance, after the plane crash or whatever, although Hank wasn't there for that necessarily. Okay, well, the next thing that I want to talk about go ahead. Yeah, go. Sorry.
Yeah, and to return to something you just said just now, I think they could make 8 episodes out of the Hank versus Walt storyline, because it wouldn't be the only storyline there. Like, there would be the question of, well, does Jesse sit with Walt or turn against him? What about Mike? Does... You know, what's the relationship between Jesse and Mike after all of this happens? What's the fallout with Skyler and Walt's family? What's the fallout with Marie and Hank's family? Like, I think there are a lot of ways in which this could play out where it doesn't have to be just Hank chases Walt around Albuquerque for 8 episodes.
No, that's true, but I still feel like that's a long amount of time in Breaking Bad time for something to happen, for like a process to happen.
Okay, sure. That's fair.
For one little stay, you know what I mean. Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is we meet another character that we've actually gotten to see in all the subsequent episodes, this being Lydia. My first thought here, of course, was this girl looks exactly like Allison Brie, and for more substance on her, let's go. Dom, what do you have to say?
Okay. I wasn't really sure what to make of Lydia as a character. Like, I see that the character is one that needs to be there. Like, there has to be some intermediary at Madrigal between, like, the company as a whole and Walt and Mike and Jesse's operation. But I'm not sure that the character of Lydia was the best person to involve in that. Like, I think this is someone who has had to, presumably, claw her way into this role, who has been successful at this for a long time, someone who was evidently trusted enough by the people around her, including Gus, that she was trusted with the information that she needed in order to do this. And yet she comes across as very scared, as worried, as not very, as lacking confidence. It just seems like this is an odd set of personality traits to have for someone in her position.
Also, you know, the first scene we see her with Mike in the diner, where she is acting like this is her first time she's ever done anything like this, and it struck me like she doesn't seem like the kind of person that Mike would be really wanting to work with.
Well, yeah, if anything, Mike is supposed to be answering to her. Like, she is the person who has the notional measure of control here. Like, why is she the one who seemingly can't keep her act together?
Well, I mean, she's now in a much different position than she was in before, because she's a middleman, basically, with the methylamine between Gus and the however she's getting it, the Madrigal. Where, and now that Gus is out of, like, now that Gus is out of the picture, she's suddenly ascended into this new role where she may not know who she's working with, and she's now maybe having more responsibility than she wants, and she's not handling it that well, instead of just easily saying, okay, I'm just going to take this methylamine from point A to point B.
I guess I just don't see the advantage of portraying her like this instead of as a cool, calm, collected businesswoman who has to be ruthless in order to get what she wants.
I can understand this if you want to then drive the plot line that, oh, she may be setting up her own little fake devices and we might need to kill her and whatever, which for the sake of the story, but I can see what you mean in terms of realistic terms.
But I think if the storyline that you're trying to create is Lydia is dangerous enough that she needs to be removed as soon as possible, it would be easier to convince the audience of that if she was shown as this very focused, driven person who could, you know, outmaneuver Mike and Walt and Jesse if she wanted to, rather than as someone who is dangerous solely because she's erratic and might fly off the rails.
Well, what we've seen is people who are rational and have everything together and always have a plan, such as Gus, have a tendency to get outmaneuvered by Walt. So perhaps maybe this irrational thing is really the best line of defense. And, may, you know, and that's perhaps just grasping at straws, but I can kind of dig that like the best line basically for her is just to be a spaz and make herself unpredictable so she can't get outmaneuvered by Walt.
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm not totally sold on that either.
Yeah, well, I guess I think a lot of people have these concerns about Lydia, and I think these play into wider concerns about how the show portrays female characters. Now, a lot of people have said, well, look at Lydia and then look at Skylar and Marie, who have both come under a lot of criticism as characters, and even though I think most people would agree that the actresses do the best that they can in those roles, but the characters themselves just maybe, I don't know, aren't presented in the way that they need to be in order to fulfill the roles that the editors are creating for them. Like, Skylar is supposed to be the antithesis to Walt, so she has to have this kind of inherent likability to make it clear that Walt is the enemy in the situation, and yet it seems like a lot of the Breaking Bad audience hates Skylar and seems to take more to Walt for some reason. Now, do you think that's do you think that's a failure on their part, or do you think it's a failure on the part of the writers to create these roles in such a way that they're convincing in the parts that they're intended to play?
If I had to choose between only those two options, I would take the latter. However, I'm actually a fan of these of the females. Most, you know, of course, to this point, the only ones we really had in most of the episodes are Skylar and Marie, who both of whom I can't complain about the same way I could about a lot of people who aren't that great at writing female characters. Aaron Sorkin, who is otherwise great. But for example, like Deb from Dexter, I just cannot stand. And there are a lot of people like that where I think they try to write female characters and just can't. And I don't think that's the case here. I think these are, they're just not standard. They're not subservient to Hank and Walt necessarily, and that may rub people the wrong way or whatever, but I'm totally fine with that, and I think it's nice to have characters that anything can really happen, where they're not, we don't always necessarily know what to expect, certainly, and I think that's certainly something we've seen out of Skylar this season, and what I'm most interested in really is these writers having options.
I think
and I like that.
I think what a lot of people object to is that there's no female character on the show that seems to be confident in her own shoes. Like, Skylar seems to range between being an emotional wreck or trying to stand up for herself but not being able to do so because what has her in this constant state of duress. Marie is just there seemingly as comedy value, which she is a lot of the time, and I think she's very good at that. Like, I think Marie is a good character to have on the show, but she's clearly not one that is a strong woman that's going to be likeable and relatable. And similarly, I think Lydia is someone who could have been written in such a way, but wasn't for whatever reason. Which leaves a gap in the show for someone like that who I think people can relate to in that way.
I think you're right. I'll address a couple things in various order. I think you're right, first of all, that I would have preferred to see Lydia be someone just like super capable and someone who is really like a player with these people that could potentially like throw her hat into the ring. Although I would say, to me, that would be like, okay, well, she's inevitably going to lose to Walt. Like, however she thinks she's going to outmaneuver him, it's not going to work. And I, for Lydia, like I said, having that kind of irrationality, I think, is a good thing for this season to kind of mix it up. And I'm not so sure that we really need something like that on this show because we have so much about Walt, like, masterminding and Saul then being this sharp, you know, somewhat sharp legal mind who is claiming at the end of the day to just be, like, Walt's Huckleberry and whatever. And I'm not so sure. I think I kind of like having, in a world where, in, like, the drug trade world and the meth distribution world where everyone's just in it for themselves, I like that Marie kind of represents every woman who's just kind of like a single-handed chorus where she's responding on behalf of, like, everyone who would just be hearing this news organically. And I think she's very human in those responses, and I really like that. And I think that's a lot of what adds to the show is that we get these very human responses out of these characters. And I think the women add a lot to that. Because straight up, honestly, that's how women are a lot in real life. They don't think the same way. And that to show that on the show, I don't think is something to really criticize them for. Because it's how many female meth kingpins are there?
Right, that's true. And I think there's an argument you made that you couldn't write a female into the same role as, say, Mike, for instance, or Gus. Like, there's just, like, this is a thing where it's like you can't have a black James Bond just because the whole context changes if you try to do that. It's like,
it's not wrong. It's just not something you can do.
In an ideal world where, like, the drug world is a bastion of equality, yes, you could have female drug kingpins. But when you're trying to construct what is, to some degree, an accurate representation of the show, like, there has to be an element of realism there for you to have, like, these anti-realist or unrealistic scenes at some point. Like, you can't take liberties by having someone like Gus as a female character or whatever. So, to some extent, the female characters in Breaking Bad do have to be, like, subservient or less than confident or whatever, and I understand that to a degree. I also think that one of the best things about a show like Breaking Bad is that it doesn't easily pigeonhole characters into being either good or bad, where it's like, you're supposed to clearly root for this person, and you're supposed to clearly root against this person, and it kind of infantilizes the audience where it tells you what to do. Like, I think a lot of people end up sympathizing with Walt in a kind of perverse way, but then when you check yourself, you realize this is a guy who has done horrible, horrible things, who's clearly not a good person at all, and when you realize that, you kind of almost feel guilty for yourself for actually empathizing with him in the first place. And I think it's kind of a similar thing with Skylar, where it's like, Skylar, compared to Walt, is clearly the good guy in the situation. She is clearly the hero to his, not anti-hero, but villain. And yet she is not someone who you can root for very easily on her own merits. Like, her goodness is constituted by her victimhood, which isn't really a good reason to root for someone.
Yeah, the entire concept of good guys and bad guys in this series is completely skewed because Walt is set up the whole time as, like, the protagonist and hero who's doing a bad thing, but for the right reasons. And now it's at the point where he and Skylar are always fighting with each other, and maybe his motives aren't even so pure anymore because he now thinks he's cancer-free, and now he wants the money because the streets are lined with gold or whatever. And just as a quick side note before I forget this, if you, I think like the, people have tried, I think tried and failed. If you want to look at Weeds, which is basically Breaking Bad, but with a female lead, it's the same idea where an average female person ends up selling marijuana instead of meth. But it gets remarkably unrealistic very, very quickly. And just because I think it requires a different kind of brain, and not to get like, you know, home of casual sexism or whatever. I think it's really not an option that they have if they want to maintain this. What I would say, however, is I could totally get behind, and I hope to see a very strong female on the law enforcement end.
Yeah, definitely. I can see that. Although I think that'd be
a really good thing to do, especially as I'm imagining we're going to start seeing more law enforcement as it pertains to Walt.
Yeah, although I think one of the nice things about the way in which they portray the DEA in general, and in particular Hank and Gomez, is that it is a very male-dominated world where there is like casual sexism flying around. And this is another great thing about Hank, with Hank's character, is that Hank is, if you were to rank, and I know this is kind of simplistic, but if you were to like rank people in Breaking Bad in terms of goodness or badness, Hank would be one of the more sympathetic characters on the list. And yet he's someone who seems kind of chauvinistic, who comes up with like sexist and racist nicknames for people. Like he has flaws to him as well. And I think this is a good thing where it's not like if you showed Hank getting on perfectly with a female superior, that would kind of undermine what we know about Hank as a character. And it would lead to a more simplistic portrayal of Hank, which is not something that we want.
Right. Yeah. It's completely mixed up in terms of the perspectives of who's good and bad, because like you say, Hank perhaps has some character flaws, but he's always consistently fighting the good fight and enforcing the law, whereas Walt is someone you want to root for probably more than Hank, but he's off doing illegal things and lying to Hank while Hank's trying to catch him and Hank's trying to do the right thing. And it's, like I said, it gives them a lot of options, I think, as writers, where no matter what the scene calls for, you can really sell either Walt or Hank as either a good or bad guy.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons that Jesse's transformation into almost the undisputed good guy of the show doesn't really strike a chord for me, which is, I feel like we've lost a layer to his character where before, yes, you could see that he was often correct in his interactions with Walt when they were arguing about whatever, but there were also clear flaws in his personality as well. And those seem to have been gradually dampened down over the course of this season, leaving an almost universally positive portrayal of Jesse, which is something I can't really get behind.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, I think when it's all said and done, and maybe this is recency bias, I've been thinking that I think Jesse is probably not going to die and is going to come out with a pretty sweet situation at the end of this whole deal. And now I'm thinking, now that everyone's kind of such a big Jesse fan, maybe Vince Gilligan's a cold enough bastard to take him away from us right at the end.
I can see that happening, and I would like that, actually.
So would I, because what I was thinking is, and this is a major spoiler alert as far as my own thoughts on this, is whatever analysis we end up doing for all of this season, at the end of the day, and when it's all said and done, Vince Gilligan's going to out-level us by exactly one, and we're going to get a satisfying and surprising ending, which we should have probably seen coming, but certainly will not have.
Yeah. I think whatever ending we have for the show is going to surprise us and it's going to please us. But I think those are two things that we know for certain. Firstly, I don't think this is a show where you can fuck it up in the way that you can fuck up something like Lost, where if you get it wrong, then the whole premise of the show just collapses on itself and it seems like it was for nothing. I think with Breaking Bad, even though it is an unsatisfactory ending, or one that seems to be unsatisfactory at least, I think people will still be able to appreciate the rest of the show for what it is without always going back to the question of the ending.
Yeah, sure. And we'll talk more about the ending as we get there.
Yeah, because like with Lost, the whole teleology of the show was, like, what is the whole purpose behind the island? Why is everyone here? Like, what is the mystery behind all of this? And so when the answer to that question turned out to be one that you don't actually like, then what value is there to get from the show anymore? Whereas like with Breaking Bad, you can still get satisfaction out of it even if you don't like certain aspects of the plot. Like I said, I didn't particularly enjoy the way in which the ending of Season 2 was handled. And yet I still like Season 2 and I like Season 3. And I didn't think that the way that the show kind of dipped for me between them like affected my enjoyment of it beyond that, if you see what I'm getting at.
Yeah, and also I really thought you were about to spoil the ending of Lost for everyone. I thought you were about to just get right into it, but that's okay. So the next thing I think I want to talk about is one of my favorite characters that we only have seen maybe once or twice, but this guy, the Asian guy, Chow, who a couple seasons ago had a very fun scene where Mike is kind of stalking out his place of business and his secretary's there and Mike's, you know, walking around with a gun trying to assassinate people basically. And it was cool to see Chow back and Chow's trying to smoke indoors and everything and Chow is really just living life. And of course this is all under the context of we've just seen this meeting between Mike and Lydia where Lydia's got this list of 11 people who knew about the lab and are still alive and who perhaps need to be dealt with and Chow is on that list.
Right, and so now, previously they've been silenced by a constant stream of money coming from Gus, who basically paid them hush money. But now that Gus's empire has collapsed, that money isn't coming in anymore, and now that the DEA is taking an active interest in what's going on, presumably they're going to have pressure put on them by the DEA at some point in the near future, and they're understandably worried by this. So now Lydia and Mike, in their own ways, are both trying to make sure that this doesn't become a problem.
Right, yeah, and in Lydia's case, that means get Mike to kill everyone, and if he says no, get someone else to kill everyone plus Mike. And that ends up being the person in the form of Chris that we'll be getting to, one of Mike's old guys. But before we actually get to let's get into that before we get into the interrogation, because we're kind of on this. Because I really like Chow. I thought he was one of the more interesting and, like, colorful characters. And for me, it was like, oh, hey, Chow's back. This is going to be awesome. We're going to get to see more Chow, and he's going to be a big character, and he's going to be fun, and he's dead. Like,
yeah.
He's got taken away from me so quickly.
I think Chow was best as a minor character, as a very minor character, like as a comic relief. I don't think his role was really suited for anything more than that, but I liked him while he was there.
Yeah, and, you know, he gave a very solid final performance as a corpse on that final scene between Mike and Chris.
Yeah, that was a great scene, actually, if we want to get into that. Like, we see this shot of Chow sitting there in the middle while Mike and Chris are at opposite ends of the shot. And it quickly becomes apparent to us that Chow is dead, but when we realize that, it kind of puts the whole scene into perspective. Like, there's this dead body sitting there.
Right, and it's also a situation where you should remember that Mike's sitting there just got a gun pointed at Chris after he knows Chris was just trying to kill him. And this was very wire-like to me, if I can bring that up once again, because it's very much like death is just a thing that happens, and no one really, like, when you die, that's okay, because, you know, you did what you could in life, and the game didn't really work out for you, but it was probably a good ride as it lasted, and this whole scene was like, I thought with Chow sitting there dead, Chris has just killed him, and Chris now realizing, okay, I'm probably about to die, and he's sitting there saying, like, yeah, you know, Lydia paid me to kill off these people that you wouldn't kill, and she was going to give me 30 grand just to kill you, knowing he's about to die, but it's like, why? There's no real downside, like, oh, we can kind of debrief here and get, like, a hand history review before I end up killing you, but hey, it's all in the game.
Well, I think I like the way in which they... Because I think it would be very easy in the scene to just have Mike shoot Chris and then walk out in some, like, Terminator-style fashion. But I think it was good that they almost humanized Mike in the scene, where it's like, it was clear that he didn't really want to do this, but he understood that this was the natural consequence of what had happened. It's like, he showed Chris respect as, like, a fellow soldier to ask him, like, are you ready for this? And to just shoot him clearly and get it over with and not exult about it, not act triumphant, to just get it over with, get out of there, and move on with his life.
If you're into that kind of thing, Dom, I think I have a TV show recommendation for you.
what, The Shield? Yeah.
I don't know that humanize is the word I would use. I would say not so much dehumanize, but really establish that Mike is above all a businessman who, like, is not just going to leave this loose end because he likes the guy and had, like, mentored the guy. Like, he understands what's what, that he has to kill this guy.
Yeah, but what I meant when I said it humanized him was it showed the mental and emotional toll that this business obviously takes on you. Like, Mike, you knew that this was someone who Mike had worked well with in the past, and they were now driven in a situation where only one of them could walk out of that building alive. And Mike had this, like, look of resignation as he did it. Like, I wish I didn't have to be doing this. But I don't regret doing it because I know that if I don't, then I'm going to end up dead instead. Like, this is the dark reality of the situation we're both in.
Right, yeah, and I think I always think it's cool when, but maybe cool is the wrong word here, when in scenes when both people recognize that, like, this is the reality of the situation. Like, yeah. In some, like, life or death things where it's like, I don't have a choice here. My hands are tied.
Yeah, and it was nice because we didn't see them like trying to bullshit each other or anything. They both knew what had to happen here.
Right, Chris isn't trying to talk his way out of this. He knows there's only one way this scene ends for him.
Yeah, it wasn't like he was trying to clear his name with Mike. He was just making it clear, like, okay, you understand what's happening here. I wish I didn't have to do this, but I understand and accept what you're about to do to me.
Yeah, and Chris says to Mike, like, hey, man, I'm sorry that I had to come hunt you, but I really needed the money. And Mike's like, yeah, okay, I get it.
And I like the juxtaposition of that with Chris's final reaction, where as Mike raises a gun, we see Chris clearly, like, this sort of primal urge to fight for his life, saying, no, Mike, you don't have to do this. And then, obviously, Mike was never going to listen, but he had to try anyway.
Yeah, and now, actually, we ended up skipping, and I want to get back to it now. One of my favorite scenes, perhaps my favorite scene in the history of the series, which is Hank calling Mike in to interrogate him at the DEA office, where after they've discovered these bank accounts. So let's get right into that, Dom.
Yeah, this is really good. I don't think it was the most complicated scene to pull off in the show, but I think I agree with you that it was one of the most well done, because in some ways the simple ones like this, where it's like, it's just a box-ended interrogation, mostly. But Dean Norris, playing Hank, managed to pull it off in a way that it made it in line with the kind of exaggerated things we expect from Hank's character without making it too over the top. And it's a very delicate balance to pull off, but I think he did it.
Yeah, we got a lot of kind of like sarcasm and phrases with ulterior motives, I guess, out of both of these people, like metagaming out of both of these guys. But they've been developed already this season as characters such that it's believable, which is a big part of why the show is good. And I think another thing that made this scene so great is all of the swings that went back and forth of like who's in charge, where first Mike's getting called in and then he's willing to represent himself and he's owning Hank, and then Hank's got some dirt on him. And Mike's got to deny it, and then Mike says, oh, are you going to arrest me or not, or whatever. And I like all these swings going back and forth. I think that really added a lot to the scene, where you never really even know until the end. Up through the end, I thought for sure Mike was going to come out of there looking cleaner than Hank.
Well, in a sense he does, because Hank springs this information on him, which he is sure was going to be a game breaker. Like, we know that there's an account in your granddaughter's name that has hundreds of thousands of dollars in it that definitely should not be there. And I assume at that point he's expecting Mike to just roll over and give in to some degree. But Mike, ever the consummate professional, decides, fuck you, I'm not going to do this. And I just walks out of there without a care in the world, basically.
Yeah, well, of course we end up seeing it make a difference to Mike, because now we suddenly start willing to cook, like getting back into cooking again. But you're right that Mike, doesn't he kind of make like this scowly face as he's walking out there? I would have said Hank ended up winning that in terms of Hank got in the last, like, jab.
Right, but he makes that face to the camera away from Hank. Like, as you said, it was clear that this was, like, a struggle between two alpha males, like, grappling for a position. Even if they felt defeated, they were never going to let the other one see that.
And obviously he's making that face to the camera for a reason, because he does, the point of that shot is make it look like you feel defeated here.
Right, but it's not like Mike is...
He's not that concerned about it.
It's not a look of submission from Mike. It's not saying, oh, fuck, what am I going to do now? It's, well, this is just another obstacle in my way, and as Mike does in his weird way, he is just going to get through it as best he can.
Right, yeah, and then what we end up seeing him do now is go to Lydia's house in an attempt to get her methylamine connection back instead of letting that all go away.
Right, and I think this is arguably the best scene of the episode, actually. Like, this is really... This was a Mike-centric episode, and this was something which basically summed up everything that we've seen previously. So if you want to get into what happened, then discuss.
Right, yeah, well, basically what happens is Lydia gets home, and she's got her Hispanic nanny watching her little kid, and it's, you know, the nanny's about to leave, and Lydia turns a corner, and out of nowhere is Mike, who's somehow in her house and grabs her by the mouth and shushes her and says, do not scream, or I'll kill you. He's got a gun up to her head. And basically, he's like, you need to get this nanny out of here, and we're going to go sit and have a chat right now. And the subsequent chat is that what we end up seeing Mike starting really trying to get back into the methylamine game and the working with Walter and Jesse, which he previously turned down.
Yeah, and just talking about the aesthetics of the shot a minute, I love the bit where Mike was hiding, where he was like behind this section of wall, and this bit was kind of darkened by shadow, and then the hall where Lydia and the nanny and the daughter were standing was lit up, and I thought that I thought that was really nice. Like, it really conveyed that it's kind of violatory what Mike was doing. Like, this guy with a gun is in your house, a few feet away from you, and you and your family are in danger here. And it's like...
Right. Well, and also, given that there's nothing you can even do about it, given you've just told the nanny to leave and the little daughter is a little kid. So what we ultimately end up seeing happen is Mike pulls Lydia aside into her bedroom and is like, look, listen, this is going to end one of two ways. I don't want to have to kill you right now, but if you can still get your hand on some methylamine here, which is the close of the situation, that's something that I'd be very interested in making happen. And this is something that we end up seeing come into play. Of course, now the whole hunt for methylamine is exactly what this season has been about so far, to such an extent that they end up robbing a train. But Lydia, if she can end up becoming a good methylamine source, would have been a much better, perhaps a much better option, presumably better than robbing trains here. So, Dom, what do you think about in terms of, because it seems like Lydia is not for reasons we've discussed, not the ideal candidate for their methylamine hookup, and they probably want someone more reliable, but it seems like they wouldn't really be pursuing her if they had any other justifiable options here.
Yeah, well, this represents a fundamental truth of, well, what I imagine is a fundamental truth of the drug world, which is you don't get the luxury of choosing how you do a lot of things. We've already seen that things aren't going to run smoothly for their operation, and they can't, because it would be a pretty bad TV show if Walt was just able to cook, make himself millions of dollars and then retire happily, like in a beach house somewhere. Like, things are going to go badly for them, and they're not always going to be able to work with people or work with things that they necessarily would want to if they had the choice.
Yeah, I've been sitting here watching this and seeing all these various places and how much money people in the drug trade end up making, and I was like, oh, these jobs seem fantastic, like, paid $275,000 just to keep my mouth shut. Sign me up. Like, whoever's looking for that line, I'm applying for that line of work, whatever it is. Or, like, middleman even, where, okay, I'll take this from point A to point B and just charge you a little bit more than I paid for it. That'd be fine with me, too. Although I'm thinking through that, this is the problem with doing that in the drug trade is you're not always working with the most trustworthy characters. And if you could limit your experiences to only working with professionals like Walt or like Gus Fring, that would be one thing, but that's obviously not going to be the reality of the situation, which is why it's $275,000 if you want to do this and are willing to keep your mouth shut, because you're going to die otherwise.
Yeah, and I hate to keep harping on about Mike, but now that you bring it up, it's another good point, which is Mike is a professional. Like, even though he may hate on a personal level the people that he's working with, if he makes an agreement to pay them, he's going to pay them. Like, he does business in a very old-fashioned way, where it's like he's willing to be ruthless if he has to, but he doesn't cut corners. Like, I think this was presumably what Gus saw in Mike, which is he is dependable. Like, he is a heartless bastard, but he has a good head on his shoulders, and he's going to be loyal if he needs to be.
Right, he's like Gus himself, which is, he's a businessman at the end of the day. He's in it for the money and to make, like, he's going to act correctly, and he's going to prioritize staying alive and keeping his business alive above other things.
Yeah, they're not people who were driven into this business because they were unable to operate in society. They were driven into it because, and they needed something which tested them more and which let them, you know, maximize their profit-making potential.
So this episode then ends up ending on one of the famous Walt and Skyler discussion, where one we've seen several times before, where they're in bed and it's shot like over Skyler's facing the wall and Walt's facing Skyler. And actually, this one, they may be standing up in this one, but you know, this is not the first nor the last time that we'll see Walt and Skyler in their room having arguments here. What did you think about this particular scene, Dom?
There's a lot of discussion that I saw about whether Walt did Skyler at the end constituted rape or not, and I don't really want to get into that now, like it's not really something that we want to discuss, but I think it was clear here that there was Skyler was not doing this willingly, like there was an element of a fear behind the decision, and it might not even be fair to characterize it like as that. Like, this wasn't actually a real decision for her. Like, she feels trapped in this, in what's more than a loveless marriage. It's a marriage in which she feels actively scared about her partner, which is, it's got to be pretty terrifying for her.
Yeah, and this is another thing where, after spending the whole episode basically with Mike, and usually we're spending the whole episode with Walt, where it brings us back to, like, the very personal element of it, which is, these are people who, for the first 15 years of their relationship or whatever, or 18, however old Walt Jr. is, were married and were just a husband and wife. And for all of that to just be changing so dramatically. And it's something that I don't really think about because we obviously only know the characters of Walt and Skyler from the context of when season one started through now. But they've, of course, been together for much longer than that. And so it's weird to even think about how different all this must seem for Skyler now, given this relatively new turn of events.
It's not like this is something which he is accustomed to in any way. Like,
right.
When we see them together relatively happy at the beginning of season one, obviously they've been rocked by the news that Walt has cancer now. But I presumably she thought they were just going to get through it as they had done before, as a normal loving couple. And this is the state in which they've lived for however long, 10 or 15 years. And
right,
so
and I think,
now that this radical transformation in their life has occurred over the space of, less than a year, this is something, you know, Skyler's whole life has gone through a radical upheaval. Like, this is something which she is having to adapt to as it happened without any frame of reference.
That's what I think, that's exactly what I'm about to say, is scared, I think, is a very appropriate response, because given how long they've been together, she feels, I would have to imagine at least, that she felt like she knew with a certain degree of accuracy who Walt was as a person, and to see that out of nowhere he can start doing things like cooking meth and becoming this drug kingpin has got to be a terrifying prospect when for the last 16, 17 years, you felt like you've known this guy and known what he's all about and never could have seen anything like that coming. And surely, probably never would have married and had kids with him in the first place had you known that was in the realm of possibility. So, for him to be able to just do this out of nowhere, God knows what he's willing to do elsewhere.
Yeah, it's at the point where she can presumably barely recognize the things that she saw in him originally when they were first together. And she's now seeing all the aspects of his personality that she thought were kind and innocent and genuine have been twisted and warped to become instruments of fear in his hands, and that's a shocking transformation.
Definitely. Now, before we move on to the next episode, what I'm thinking, and edit this out if this is not what you're thinking, is it perhaps an idea to put this up in two parts where we can finish recording the rest of it right now and everything, but we're already at 2 hours into this. Do we want to do this in two parts? Until now we could say, all right, well, this is going to be the end of part one, and we'll put up part two, just so it's not a 4-hour podcast for people.